You are listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Edgar B. Herwick III. Well, you might have been watching a little bit of a football game that was on yesterday. And in fact, I guess as the numbers have come out, it turns out that about half the people who own televisions were watching this football game yesterday. And why not? There was a little bit of something for everybody. If you're interested in entertainment, we had the Beyonce halftime show. If you're an electrical engineer, we had a blackout. You know, if you are a psychologist, we had a sibling rivalry being played out on the largest of stages. And if you're a sports fan, there's a pretty good football game to watch as well. And the chew over today, which we're going to do as we often do on Mondays here on Boston Public Radio. I've got with me in the studio Eric Wilbur, who is a sports blogger and reporter for Boston.com. How you doing, Eric?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. And also joining us by phone from the city of New Orleans is Shalise Mansa-Young, who's Patriots beat reporter for the Boston Globe and was down at the game in New Orleans last night. How you doing, Shalise?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
We're doing well. We're thanks so much for joining us here on Boston Public Radio today. So, Shalise, you were there for the big event, and I think that we'll get into the sporting moments and the game itself in a little bit, but I think the thing that most people are talking about this morning is the blackout. Can you take us inside the blackout and what it was like down there in the stadium when it all went down?
It was, you know, really strange. The game's going on, and then all of a sudden, half of the stadium went dark. The video boards, you know, they give off a ton of light. Both ends of the arena went dark, and, you know, play had to stop. It was odd because over the Ravens sideline, the lights never fully went out, but over the 49ers sideline, it did get really dark. The whole stadium was not, you know, pitch black, which I think was a good thing. But it was, you know, it was really a strange situation. You know, here you are on the biggest stage and all of these people watching and the whole, you know, everything just comes to a stop for 35 minutes and nobody knows what's going on.
Yeah. Was it scary? What were the thoughts or what were the things that were being said either in the, where were you? Were you in the press box? Were you down on the field?
No, I was up in the press box and in the Superdome, the main press box is up really high, close to the roof. Really, it's the highest point that you can get in the stadium. You know, as the reporters, we were all just sort of looking at each other. We're all on Twitter trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, obviously people were making a lot of jokes, but, you know, you were just kind of waiting it out and seeing if there was going to be an announcement. The only thing they said in stadium was, you know, we're working to fix it. Please, you know, we appreciate your patience, things like that. So, you know, it was definitely strange, and it ended up, it seemed like it changed the tide of the game in terms of how the 49ers were performing. And you have to wonder, would the game have turned out the way it did if you didn't have the power outage? You know, there's always that, you know, that hindsight type of thing. But it was certainly memorable, not for the reasons the NFL wanted, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. That is absolutely for sure.
What was interesting is that this morning on the CBS morning show, Armin Katayan was actually doing a piece for the, I think it's on Showtime, for Wednesday with the director of operations of the Superdome, and the lights went out as he was doing the piece, and the guy turned to him and was like, you know, what do we do? What do we do? And it was just like this total confusion that you would not even imagine.
Yeah. Shalise, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, obviously because of the stark contrast between how the game was played before the blackout and how it was played after in terms of the score, right? I mean, you sort of had pre-blackout, it was dominated by the Ravens. Post-blackout, pretty much dominated by the 49ers. So a lot of people speculating, as you are right there, about whether or not that helped sort of change the tide of the game. Did you get a sense from any of the players or coaches or people involved with the teams that they think it might have had an effect on the game?
You know, I think it depended on who you asked after the game. You know, the Ravens, Reed just said, you know, football is a game of adjustments, and everybody had to adjust to what was going on. Some players said it was the strangest thing they've ever been part of.
Huh.
And, you know, the 49ers kind of acknowledged that they had a chance to settle down, which they had just come off of halftime, so you would have thought halftime did that too, but they were just able to settle down and, you know, sort of gather themselves, and they were able to move forward from there because they did play really well from that point on. They just had dug themselves far too big of a hole before that point.
Yeah, and you know, as you said, coming out of halftime, you know, of course, there was this huge kick return, 108-yard kick return by the Ravens right out of the half, and the blackout came shortly after that. So maybe another chance for them to regroup. Obviously, looking back, the blackout was one of the pivotal moments of this game. But, Shalice, you know, as you look back on the game, having talked with some of the players after the game, having been there, you know, amidst all of the press and people chewing over what happened, besides the blackout, were there a couple of moments that stood out for you in this game that were pivotal, that were really, you know, the moments that the game hinged on?
You know, certainly I think what you said, the kickoff return, and that actually may have been what the 49ers needed to recover from more than anything, was just, you know, here they are, they come out of halftime, they've, you know, made the adjustments that they thought they needed to make, and then all of a sudden they're down 7 more points. They were already down 15, and now all of a sudden they're down 22. You know, I think that was important. I think the play that Joe Flacco had when it looked like he was being forced out of bounds and he made that great third down play, that was big in the first half. And then, of course, the end of the game when the 49ers could not get in from 5 yards out. That is going to be something that I'm sure they look at and mull over for the next 7-8 months until training camp starts again.
And from that standpoint, too, I mean, the 49ers, they fell asleep in the beginning, you know, much like they did in the NFC Championship game against the Falcons. They just couldn't recover from that early deficit. And I think that's ultimately what really killed them.
So, you know, I'm going to take this to both of you. Shalice, maybe you can go first. One of the things that was talked about a lot in the lead up to this game, partly because it's a fun storyline, is the fact that we had these two brothers who were coaching against each other.
I hadn't noticed, really.
But, you know, ultimately, I wonder, I mean, you're mentioning that final four plays from first and goal inside of the 10-yard line for the 49ers. One of the things we're hearing criticism of is the play calling in that last series by the 49ers coach. You know, did one of these brothers get the better of each other as a coach? Like, you know, looking at the game, did one coach outcoach the other, or was it sort of more the players there?
No, you know, I think that all of those things play, you know, a role in ultimately what happens in a game. I think play calling was an issue. Play calling and clock management was also an issue for the 49ers toward the end of the first half.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that they dealt with on both sides of the game, you know, end of the first half, end of the game. And, you know, I think you have to give a lot of credit to Dean Pease, who used to be with the Patriots and is the defensive coordinator with Baltimore now. They did a good job against Tom Brady 2 weeks earlier. They did a good job against Colin Kaepernick, who's a completely different quarterback. You know, we hear it all the time, but it's absolutely true that it comes down to execution. Coaches can have a great game plan, but the players have to execute the way that, you know, they need to be successful.
Yeah, Eric, what's your thoughts on that, on the coaches?
I mean, so much was brought up about it in the week, you know, leading up to the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. There certainly has to be some kind of mental edge there with one coach to the other coach. I mean, if we have siblings, we kind of have this, you know, connection. You know, there's something that we know about each other that other people don't.
Yeah.
And from a coaching standpoint, going head to head, I wonder if that played in a little bit.
Yeah, I was saying, like, for me, I think you could kind of tell. Granted, the younger brother is the one who lost, but he certainly seemed just, you know, to watch them as the more petulant of the two, which
yes.
is kind of fulfilling the younger brother thing. Throwing, you know, he was sort of throwing things on the sidelines and complaining about the referees. So certainly, you know, they kind of played out looking. He certainly looked more like the younger brother. The older brother, very calm, cool, and collected. Intense, but pretty calm.
Yep, no comeback for Captain Comeback.
Yeah, that's right. So Shalice, before I let you go, I'm just curious, what's it like down there in New Orleans now post Super Bowl? Are there elated and tired Ravens fans just milling about, walking around the city, or what's going on down there?
Well, I think a large percentage of them are the NFL shop. That's where actually I am right now, because the day after the Super Bowl, all of the merchandise goes on sale.
Sorry.
So I'm picking up some stuff for my friends and family who support me throughout the season and things like that. And, you know, there's a lot of people wandering around here in Ravens purple. So they're just thrilled for what happened, and they really traveled well. There were significantly more Ravens fans, it seemed like, in the stadium than 49ers fans.
That definitely came across on television as well. You could certainly hear it. It sounded at times almost like it was a home game for the Ravens. That certainly was my take on it. Well, Shalice Mansa-Young, the Patriots beat writer for the Boston Globe down in New Orleans, thanks for checking in with us this afternoon here on Boston Public Radio.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. All right, well, I'm going to keep Eric Wilbur with me here in the studio. We're going to continue to talk a little bit about football. So just overall, your impression of the game before we move on, Eric.
Well, like we were talking about before we went on the air, you know, from the looks of it, it was one of the best Super Bowls ever.
Shaughnessy in the Boston Globe called it one of the best ever today.
And
in
I was surprised. I mean, we do have this knee-jerk reaction every time is a close game to call it, oh, it's the best Super Bowl ever.
Yeah.
And that's difficult to do because obviously in this area alone, we have the 2002 Super Bowl and then we have the 2004 Super Bowl, which I can't really pick. It's like picking your favorite child, you know? The 2001 was just so dramatic and it was the first one. The 2004 one was, you know, I was at that one and it was just the best game I've ever attended. It was just, you know, so dramatic. But last night, I think, like we were saying, I think the blackout may have taken some of the air out of the excitement because it was like you had this blowout going on and then the 49ers made their comeback. But at that point, it was almost like, you know, you pulled back a little bit emotionally because it was such a downtime. You know, I'm interested. I want to go back and watch it again maybe and see if my feelings are as
different.
Any different than I feel right now, because obviously it was a great game, but I just don't feel like it was you know, one of those historic moments.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, I think one thing that was helpful in the blackout was the fact that the rise of Twitter, it sort of gave a lot of people, I think, something to do during the blackout. There were some great tweets going on. So, but I think they also, and you know, I haven't seen, you know, I don't know that they've, you know, been able to quantify this in the ratings yet, but I think they probably lost some audience. I mean, just anecdotally talking to people, I've talked to people who sort of went away and decided to watch something else after the blackout.
Sure.
You know, I know people who just kind of left parties that they were out at or just were like, you know, I'm done. So that might have been some of it as well.
Right. And I wonder how the ratings are, you know, I mean, because it was such a blowout and then that happened and you're like, well, okay, I'm going to bed.
According to Nielsen and CBS, it was again, the most watched and probably, and I think the most watched yet again for the third year in a row television thing in the history of America.
Yep, yep.
So
and it's interesting because conspiracy theorists say, well, CBS did it to, you know, air more ads. That's not the case.
And reportedly they didn't air any more ads really through
exactly.
That.
So I mean that's not the case. They have an allotment that they air. And the other thing is that I don't even know what the show was afterward. That show after the Super Bowl is usually like the big push for
that's
a network. So why would they want to, you know, push that off to 11:30 at night when
really
could be on at 10:45?
That's probably what they were hurt by more than anything else.
Of course.
So before we move on from football, it's kind of the end of the season. So just want to kind of wrap up with a few of the storylines and get your take on it. One of the things in the lead up to this Super Bowl and really through the whole year was the concussions issue. I mean, this is going to be one of the themes from this season and I think moving forward. And, you know, we heard from Roger Goodell and President Obama in the lead up. There was this sort of back and forth about whether or not President Obama would let his daughters play football, or if he had a son, would you let your son play football? And Obama was hesitant. Goodell said that, you know, he would definitely let his son play football if he had a son. He also has daughters. On Face the Nation Sunday before the game, he was on along with Jim Nance and Phil Simms, and they were talking about this issue. And Jim Nance said something really interesting. So I want to play a little clip of Jim Nance here and then just get your take on the concussion thing looking forward for the NFL.
Research shows that at the college level, a women's soccer player is 2.5 times more likely to suffer a concussion than a college football player. I don't hear anybody saying right now, should we put our daughters in these soccer programs? The point is, this issue spreads well beyond the NFL.
Jim Nance, of course, is an analyst for CBS Sports. I played his clip because you sort of expect that Roger Goodell will say, well, of course I would let my kids play football. He's the commissioner of football. He's definitely got a dog in the race. Jim Nance kind of does because, you know, he's a football analyst. But here he's sort of highlighting the fact that the concussion issue isn't just for football.
Yeah. Jim Nance, I mean, get off your high horse. I mean, please. I think a more realistic viewpoint is what Rodney Harrison said last week in that he's concerned. I mean, this is a guy that is on one of the biggest football shows in the country on Sunday night in America. And he's coming out and saying that he's concerned about it because he will get dizzy or he can't face bright lights because of concussions he's had in the past. That's more the viewpoint I want to hear. I don't want to hear Jim Nance towing the line for Roger Goodell because he's, you know, part of basically the league.
Yeah.
So I think you really have to take that with a grain of salt.
I mean, even this morning, right here on this station at 89.7, during Morning Edition, we heard a report about concussions, and Ed Reed, who played in last night's game, talking about the fact that sometimes he wakes up in the morning and says, what the heck happened to my memory?
Right.
This is an active player.
I mean, obviously this is a bigger concern than it was, you know, 10, 20 years ago. One, because we're educated, but two, because you know, these guys are bigger, faster, stronger, and whether that's training or whether that's PEDs, equipment, you know, I mean, the equipment obviously has evolutionized to the point where they're almost weapons, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, these pads are not just the pads they had in the 60s and 70s. They're hard plastic. Who knows what it is? Titanium? I mean, who knows what they're made of? Same thing in hockey. You know, hockey's got a concern there too, and they're going to have to address it at some point as well.
Yeah. You talked about PEDs. That's another one of the things that I think is going to be an issue. Was this year starting to be talked about a little bit more, certainly in other sports like baseball and cycling. It's been hugely in the news already in 2013. Roger Goodell yesterday before the Super Bowl also addressed this and looking ahead at potential testing for human growth hormone, which is something the league's not doing right now. Here's what he had to say. A little technical issue there on our part, so I'll just go ahead and talk about what Goodell said, which is basically he said testing's coming. We want to make it happen. You know, when asked what was going to stop it at this point, he said, "Well, we need an agreement with the players' union, but we're hoping to get there." Do you think this is this a PR move? Is this league getting serious about testing for human growth hormone?
I find it ironic that Major League Baseball is the first one to test for HGH, considering how long they had their head in the sand about their you know, steroid problem. Goodell is very evasive on a lot of these issues. And I think it was Friday, his press conference down in New Orleans didn't really answer any of those questions. It was almost like the questions were planted.
Yeah.
You know, I do think a lot of it is PR, but the league has to do something. It doesn't want to affect its product at all. And that's the unfortunate part about this, is that football is so popular. You know, it's billions and billions of dollars are invested in this. And if there's any kind of, you know, hit that it takes, it's going to take a hit in the ratings. It's going to take a hit in fantasy. It's everything is, you know, is money driven in the NFL right now.
Yeah.
And at the height of its popularity, to come out and admit that you have these problems, whether it be drugs or concussions, is really going to affect the product.
So you think, I mean, what's the answer here? I mean, you know, on the one hand, like you said, we have this concussion issue that we're talking about, and they're talking about, you know, improving testing or improving equipment. But if there's performance-enhancing drugs that are making the players bigger and faster and stronger, those things are at odds, right?
Right. I mean, you take baseball, you know, the home run numbers were up, and people, purists didn't love it. You know, it was a matter of, it got to be a joke.
But in the pop culture, it was huge. The race for 61
and
home
that's
runs
the problem.
That summer,
you know,
was
baseball
huge.
Has not taken a hit. It's back to its quote unquote pure form, and we as baseball fans love it. Not the average fan that was out there wanting to see Barry Bonds hit the ball 800 feet. In football, you know, you take that away and you take away the strength and the speed of the game as it is now, and you're reverting back to, you know, a inferior product. You know, quote unquote. And I just wonder if the general American audience is going to want that.
It's an interesting question for them to grapple with. One other football thing, and I'd love to get your take on this, is the issue of minority hiring in the NFL. It's something that was addressed a few years ago with something called the Rooney Rule. And this is in particular for coaches and general managers. These are major positions. So right now in this league, 70% of the players are black. You only have 3 head coaches that are black. You've got one who's of Puerto Rican and Mexican descent, so only 4 minority head coaches. Over this offseason, there were 15 major positions open, 8 head coaching jobs, 7 general manager jobs. None went to minority hires. So we've had this thing called the Rooney Rule, which is after Pittsburgh Steelers, Art Rooney, the owner, who had came up with this idea that said, look, if you have one of these positions open, you gotta at least interview a minority candidate. Post-Rooney Rule, we saw the numbers go up. Now they're trending down. Is this a problem for the NFL?
I don't think it's necessarily a problem. I'm not a big fan of the Rooney Rule, just because imagine you're a guy like Romeo Crennel, and you're brought into...
he's an African... Just to clarify for those who don't know Romeo Crennel,
exactly.
African-American,
yep.
Former head coach.
Yep. And you're brought into, say, Arizona as just a, you know, just to have an interview just for this rule.
Yeah.
I mean, how does that make you feel as an individual, as a professional? That saying, you know, at the same time, Romeo Crennel is probably worthy of a head coaching job.
Yep.
You know, I think he's been dealt a bad hand. And I think a lot of teams really need to, you know, look at minority candidates. But at the same time, you've got to hire the right guy.
Yeah.
So it's kind of 50-50 there with me.
I mean, do you feel like, you know, there's some people talking about we should expand the rule beyond just head coaching and general manager jobs, but for every coordinator job or for every job that you have, you should have to hire a minority candidate. You know,
that makes a little more sense to me, I think.
It does.
I think if you're going to expand it to, you know, all sorts of jobs, I think that's a more logical approach to taking to fill in those positions.
All right, I'm talking with Eric Wilbur. He's a sports journalist, a writer, a blogger for Boston.com. We're talking about the Super Bowl, which went off yesterday. Moving on, there was another game yesterday involving a local team, the Celtics, where they pulled out a victory. Their fourth straight win since they lost Rondo for the season, and everybody sort of said, well, that's it. The Celtics season is over. They're done. Now they've won four straight. What's going on here?
I don't know. You know, like we talked a little about this last week, that maybe they will be a little bit better without Rondo because of the defensive approach they have, number one. Number two, maybe there's just more cohesiveness in the locker room without his,
selfish presence.
Yeah, exactly. But so far, so good. Now, the real hit is Jared Sullinger.
So talk to us about him. He's somebody that I don't think, you know, I think a lot of people who just kind of semi-follow the Celtics, they know who Rajon Rondo mm-hmm. is. He's kind of a big name. Sullinger's a rookie. He's a younger player and somebody that I don't know a lot of people know about, so they don't understand the impact.
Right. He's a rookie. He fell in the draft because he's had back issues in college. And then it came out on Friday that he has had back surgery and he's done for the season. Now, why this is such an immediate impact is, one, you know, you're losing two of your best and most important players at the same time within 5 days of each other. But with Sullinger, it's a little bit different because you wonder about him going forward. Without Rajon Rondo, I think the Celtics can win this year.
Yeah.
Without Jared Sullinger and not knowing his future, I mean, as a rookie, having back problems.
Yeah, it sounds awful.
It could be a real kick to the back, not to use that word. You know? But, I mean, he's a franchise player, and I think that if you have concerns about him going forward, this franchise is going to take a hit, and they're not getting any younger, obviously. But the fact that you've got Pierce and Garnett still playing at such a high level is very encouraging. But the Sullinger thing, it's just awful, awful news.
Do you think that if, you know, obviously right now they're playing well, do you think if it goes south, do you see them start to move some of these pieces? Do you see a Paul Pierce or a Kevin Garnett or a hurt Rajon Rondo leaving via trade before the end of this year?
Well, Rondo he's here for the future now. I mean, if they were going to trade him, obviously they would have done it before Sunday, and they can't do that.
Yeah.
Or last Sunday. But the problem with Rondo is that now his value is so low because he's got to prove that he can come back from this injury next season.
Which is not a sure thing.
Which is
Injury that does end careers.
Especially in the NBA. So he's got to come back and prove he can do you know, what he's done in the past next year. And then the following year is the last year of his contract. So if you're going to trade him, you're still 2 years away. With Pierce and Garnett, there was the rumor about, you know, the Clippers talked about him yesterday, and then, you know, they wanted to see if they could work out a deal. But Garnett has a no trade, and he probably wants to stay here. If he's going to go anywhere, though, he'd go home to L.A., you know, so that's a little bit of an intriguing thing. I don't know if what the Celtics are going to get back in return is really worth such a deal as that. I say you got to see what these next 2 weeks hold. You know, if they keep playing like this, let's just go for May and let's try and play into June. But if they start, you know, falling apart a little bit, or if Doc Rivers sees, you know, certain things that aren't really working, Danny Ainge is going to have to get on the phone and get rid of these two guys.
Well, if nothing else, they're going to keep it interesting, at least for the time being.
Sure.
Worth watching.
I mean,
it's
fantastic week for them. I mean, it's exciting, and it proved a lot of people right that, you know, said that Rondo, while a great player, may not be the best teammate, and I think they're showing that right now.
I'm talking with Eric Wilbur. He's a writer and a blogger for Boston.com. So yesterday was the 47th Super Bowl, but a tradition that stretches even longer than the Super Bowl in this town kicks off today, and that is the 61st annual Bean Pot Tournament. Talk to us a little bit about what the Bean Pot Tournament is. I think this is so cool. As somebody who's not from this area, I love this tradition.
Very
I love
indigenous
this.
To Boston. It's a very Boston thing. It's four of the best college hockey teams in the country, basically, you know, Northeastern, Harvard, Boston College, and Boston University. They face off tonight, and there's two games, and it's usually dominated by BU. You know, in the recent history,
historically,
recent history has BC, you know, which is could win the title again this year. You know, taking the beanpot a lot, and Northeastern and Harvard are always the
also rans,
the ugly stepchildren.
The poor guys. Yeah. So how does it work? They each play each other, and then the winners advance and play for the beanpot next week, next Monday. It all happens at the Garden, right? So it's pretty cool. Yep. Like you've got, you know, college hockey happening in like a huge arena.
Exactly.
And is it, do you play, how do you, is it like luck of the draw for who you play in the first round? Do they draw them out, or is it always the same, or how does it work exactly?
I think it's usually the same.
Yeah.
I'm actually not sure about that, because you always want that BC-BU matchup in the end.
That's what you're hoping for.
That's usually what you want. So, you know, I only went to grad school in Boston, so I didn't go to college, so I didn't get that that huge feel of what it meant to be a hockey fan here.
Yeah.
But, you know, in covering it in the past and all that and going to the games, it's a lot of fun. It's just a real raucous atmosphere there, because all these kids are, you know, pumped up and amped up for their teams. And it's a really good time to go to.
Yeah. So that's pretty – and it's – I mean, it's televised. I mean,
yep.
And
televised it.
Pretty quality – I mean, in terms of, like, quality of hockey – I mean, if you're somebody who just normally maybe catches a Bruins game here and there, you just kind of watch a little hockey, worth watching. I mean, is the quality?
Oh, sure.
Is the quality real good?
Sure. I mean, many of these kids are going to the pros, you know, these are four of the best programs in the country. So, when you combine that in such a small atmosphere, you know, the area around the Garden is going to be packed with the college kids, you know, all the bars are going to be packed.
Yeah.
And it's just a real fun time to go down and soak up that, you know, collegiate atmosphere.
Yeah, real something. And like you said, this is something that is very unique to Boston. I mean,
yep.
certainly, you know, college hockey, I don't think there's a town beyond Boston where it's that big. Maybe a few in the Midwest, there are
Fargo
some cities and some towns where college hockey's big, but it's something that's unique to hear in the Beanpot thing. Really cool thing. So that's this Monday, next Monday, at the Garden and on television, so you can catch some college hockey. How are the Bruins looking?
Boy, after Thursday's hiccup, they looked fantastic on Saturday night. You know, it's funny. Chris Bork, who's the son of Ray Bork, scored that first goal, and that was all that the Bruins needed, because Tuukka Rask was dominant in net.
Yeah.
And it's funny, because Chris was sat down. He didn't play in Thursday's game. And the fact that he came out, scored that goal, they've got a lot going for them right now. I mean, they've only lost that one game on Thursday. Big things are ahead for this team.
And they look strong.
Between Rask and Hubotin, who is their backup goaltender, they look real nice in net. And you got to wonder if Tim Thomas is sitting in Colorado somewhere saying, boy, I wish I'd come back for one more year.
No
because
kidding.
This unit is it's really solid, and it's a fun team to watch.
Yeah, there was a lot of concern about the Tim Thomas thing, and it's just not.
Well, Rask has really stepped up his game. I mean, he had some hiccups.
He's got the more fun name too, Tuukka Rask, right? I mean, it's much more fun to like
to
chant that from the stands than Tim. I mean, Tim Thomas, fine, it's a fine name, but like, it's not like Tuukka Rask, you know. So okay, before we wrap this up, you know, football is over officially now. So it is time to turn the page, and right on cue, tomorrow is Truck Day for the Red Sox,
which is
the only city I've ever been to where Truck Day is celebrated. I mean, celebrating pitchers and catchers reporting is early enough, but this is even a few days earlier. This is the equipment truck, which is going to leave Fenway Park tomorrow with all the gear down into Florida to get spring training set up. Do you get excited about Truck Day?
Oh God, it's one of the dumbest things I've ever witnessed. I mean, this used to be
people get into it though.
It's unbelievable. This used to be a photo on the front page of the Globe where the truck was, you know, it was headed south. And that was about it. You know, now we cover it with, you know, photo galleries and pictures of the trucks. And my colleague Steve Silva is one of the best at this. He takes pictures of the truck. And, you know, he has galleries from like 10 years past of the truck leaving. It's a birthright of spring. You know, it's a sign that the Red Sox are going to be playing again within, you know, two and a half months or a month and a half.
But it's our own Groundhog's Day.
But
right?
The Red Sox, of course, have milked this for everything. You know, they've made it an event, and Major League Baseball has caught on to it, and there are truck days everywhere else in America.
Yeah.
It's just, It's insane. But at the same time, it really is a sign that baseball's around the corner.
And does hope spring eternal this year for baseball? I mean, you looking forward to baseball?
Yeah, oh, of course. I think the Red Sox are going to be better than people think they are. I think a lot of the moves they made were good tweaks. And if John Farrell can get in the head of John Lester and get John Lackey back to where he was, this team could surprise a lot of people.
Yeah, I think in some ways, I think it really benefits them for the first time in a long time to be going into a season with fairly low expectations or no
exactly.
expectations.
Exactly.
I mean, I think that's really going to work in their favor this
year.
And
it's more fun, too.
Yeah.
That way, everything's gold. You know, you weren't expecting it, and you're getting that return. That's a lot of fun as a baseball fan.
All right, Eric Wilbur, Boston.com sports writer, sports journalist. Thanks for being with us here again
Thank
on
you.
Boston Public Radio. And there is Callie Crossley. Well, Eric was just saying, Callie, that the atmosphere around the garden is going to be kind of fun and crazy for the Beanpot Ice Hockey Tournament, which is going on today. I would imagine with all the drinking going on, some people will be taking cabs to and from.
We hope so, yeah. Anyway. And
we advocate cabs, please.
We do.
Or the tea.
But cab drivers are complaining about the credit cards and how it's not helping them. In fact, it's eating away at their livelihood. We'll have one right here in the chair to talk about what it means for them and then what it means for us as consumers.
I'm interested in this as somebody who takes cabs.
Me
so
too.
I'm looking forward to this segment. I'm Edgar B. Herwick III.
I'm Callie Crossley, and this is Boston Public Radio.